With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to SI's Planet Football Podcast, where each week we discuss the latest in the world of soccer. I am SI.com soccer editor, Avi Krediter, joined today by SI senior writer, Grant Wall, SI.com's Brian Strauss. We are coming to you all just before the U.S. Women's National Team takes on China in the Women's World Cup quarterfinals. Grant, let's welcome you in first from the ground in Canada. How are you?
I'm doing well here in the Great White North. I got to go to Edmonton for the first time in my life for USA against Colombia. Very far north.
Farthest north. Are there Wayne Gretzky statues on every corner?
There were not. But it was kind of fascinating and weird in the sense that it's a long ways from the border, actually. That's why there were fewer U.S. fans at the Colombia game. And there was still light in the sky at midnight, and the sun would come up at like 4 in the morning, which in itself was just sort of crazy. But I'm in Vancouver now, flying to Ottawa tomorrow for USA-China. It's a big country, as I've learned here covering this tournament. Went to Ottawa last week. And I'm getting a real good taste of Canada, not just the big three cities of Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. Been to Winnipeg now, been to Ottawa, been to Vancouver, been to Edmonton. So kind of getting around. I fully expect to be in Montreal for a semifinal between the U.S. and either France or Germany. It's a crazy knockout round setup for the U.S. where, in my opinion, the first two knockout round opponents, Colombia and China, are easier than any of the three U.S. group stage opponents. That's not to say China can't win the game, because I think there's interesting circumstances involved here with two of the U.S.'s best players being suspended on yellow cards, Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holliday, and China playing some pretty good soccer. And the U.S. right now not playing very attractive soccer. The back line has been fantastic, as people have seen. Julie Johnston is becoming a star before our eyes. Hope Soler hasn't really been tested much since the first game, but the midfield just doesn't seem to be able to create much of anything. And the few times it has been through Rapinoe, who's going to be out. So strange time right now for U.S. fans. And it's really hard to get a sense of how to measure this team's performance in the World Cup, just because of lately the quality of the opposition.
It is something where, you know, you hear a lot of the players saying, you know, we haven't peaked yet. We haven't peaked yet. We're still winning, but we haven't peaked. And that's true. And you don't want to peak in the group stage necessarily. You don't want to peak until a quarterfinal, semifinal, final. But at some point you got to kind of show potential, and we haven't really seen a whole lot of it. A ton of factors obviously play into that. And ultimately they are winning. Look, if this was the U.S. men, right, and they had just won the group of death and skated to the quarterfinals of the World Cup without playing all that well, Jurgen Klinsmann would be given a lifetime extension. I mean, it's, you know, the standard bars are so different for two teams, right? And so, you know, the U.S. women, they get this 1999 final rematch with China, which I think is a pretty cool little wrinkle. Yeah. And then after that, the tests get ramped up considerably with either Germany or France, like you said, in a potential semifinal. And then the other side of the bracket, I mean, look, Japan looks fantastic. Australia's playing very well. And then Canada or England will be in the semifinal on that side as well. So we'll see what happens. back to China 1999 final. I kind of want to get your guys' memories of that game. Where you were, what you saw. Obviously, Sports Illustrated. We've got the Chastain cover, which is one of, you know, the all time great covers that this place has ever put out. Brian, start with you on this. Just where were you for that?
I was in the Washington Post newsroom. I had just started at the Post. And was only starting, you know, I started basically on the desk, you know, answering phones and handling press releases and being the guy who wrote up the two paragraphs on the George Mason women's volleyball team. But they knew I knew soccer and I was still playing at that point and for a lot longer, fortunately. But yeah, so I mean, I'd started covering a few high school and college games here and there, and so on the day of the final, they wanted me in the office sort of as, you know, someone who knew a bit about what was going on. And I remember my duty wound up being, we did a big graphic of the shootout. And so I watched each of the penalty kicks and actually like on a piece of paper drew, you know, arrows and things to indicate where the kick went and how strong it was and which way the goalie dove and that kind of thing. And I made this little art project out of the shootout, and then, you know, the magicians in the graphics department recreated it into a cool graphic on the sports page the next day. So that was how I covered my first Women's World Cup final.
That's pretty cool. Grant, what about you?
Fully expecting Avi to say that he was preparing for his first year of preschool at this time. Damn. In 1999.
Easy.
But my memory was I was in the stadium that day at the Rose Bowl, and there had been so much hype and buildup for that week. You have to remember that before that tournament, there really wasn't much attention at all. No one really expected this Women's World Cup would become this transcendent event that it became. And yet there was an entire week off between the semifinals and the final. And we're not used to seeing that these days in World Cups, but that's the way that tournament was scheduled. And that week of buildup allowed it to become something gigantic. It allowed the media to descend on the Los Angeles area in unprecedented ways for anything connected to U.S. soccer, in my opinion. I think it was even more than the 94 Men's World Cup team. You might disagree with me on that, but I think that was the case. And then, you know, it allowed people from all over the country to if they were hardcore fans or just had gotten caught up in this, to go to Pasadena. Incredibly hot that day. It's no coincidence to me that two World Cup finals, one men's, one women's, have been played in the Rose Bowl at that time of year, and both ended up 0-0 and going into penalties. It was suffocating, the amount of heat. You know, I remember Michelle Akers, you know, hitting her head in that game long before we had concussion protocols and leaving the game, and she was basically completely out of it. You know, I remember just the way the game went and how much tension there was, and how Christine Lilly cleared a ball off the line like, you know, a little like Megan Klingenberg did in this tournament when the goalkeeper for the U.S. had been beaten. You know, I remember just how everything played out with the penalties, and everything sort of moved in slow motion from my perspective, just trying to be on top of everything because I knew this would be a potentially historic story for Sports Illustrated magazine. So you really did. It was one of those rare occasions where as it was happening, you felt a sense of history in real time. And then after the game, I remember just trying to do as much interesting reporting as possible. I wanted to find out, and I remember the lead to my story was about how they chose who took the penalty kicks, because there was a lot of intrigue in that process as far as who was going to go first, how it changed, how Mia Hamm originally didn't want to take a penalty, which was you know, sort of revealing, but then she got her courage up and said, yes, I'll take it. And how Brandi Chastain was asked by Tony DiCicco, I want you to take it with your left foot, which was, she was not a left-footed player. There's so much going on with that. And then I remember in my efforts to not just go to the press conference and get stuff, I kind of snuck in to the post-game U.S. party that night. with David Hershey, a fellow soccer scribe, used to cover soccer for the New York Daily News. And I got stuff at that party that nobody else had that was good for my magazine story. Like, Michelle Akers didn't do any post-game media interviews because of her leading the game with his head injury and being totally overcome with exhaustion. And I spoke to her at that event. So, you know, for me, it was just a total adrenaline rush, you know, thinking back to that. I remember going back to my hotel in LA and just staying up all night to write the story and being so just kind of overloaded at the end of it that I couldn't sleep. It was like 6 a.m. and it was just such a big moment to be associated with. And I was like 25 at the time. So, you know, it was just an event that that I will never forget covering.
That's pretty cool. Really cool perspective. And based on how you think I was 3 years old at the time, I must have been putting like macaroni on a piece of paper and making dioramas of Brandi Chastain's penalty. No, I was at summer camp, though.
This is crazy nostalgia because, of course, we're recording this a 5 years and a day after Donovan's goal. And, of course, yesterday we had all the nostalgia over that, and now today over the 99 final.
Yeah, it's pretty cool how every summer now, especially, you know, when there are all these events, you know, you get all these year to the day of. I believe today is actually also the year to the day that Luis Suarez bit Chiellini last year. So it's just a lot of cool, you know, anniversaries, just remembering some pretty awesome times, both on and off the field. Those are really cool stories.
It's kind of remarkable how I don't cover it closely enough to know the sort of the intricacies of why, but how far China fell from that.
Yeah.
From the era of Sun Wen and a team that was, you know, inches away from winning a Women's World Cup to where now, I mean, you know, they didn't even qualify for the 2011 tournament. They've come into this tournament, I guess, a very young and untested team that had, you know, I mean, what they hadn't won a game in 6 months, right, when the tournament had started. So, you know, I'd be curious to know more about sort of the cultural, financial, sporting reasons or whatever that China was a world power 15 years ago and now is a team that's probably feeling very good about having made the quarterfinals.
Well, I think a big part of it is they did have an amazing generation of players, Sun Wen chief among them, but not the only one. I remember the player Liu Ling was just a stud midfielder in that tournament in 99 when China beat the defending champions Norway 5-0 in the semifinals, just obliterated them. And you know, just a lot of I've been talking about you know, that old China team with Jerry Longman from the New York Times this week, because he wrote a book on it. He went to China back in the day and talked to all these players. And Gao Hong, the goalkeeper who had an attitude, and there was a lot of personality on that Chinese team. And you know, it's interesting to hear where some of those players are now. And a couple of them are actually here at this tournament, including Sun Wen. So I get into Ottawa, and I'm hoping to track a couple of the Chinese players down because, you know, they, you know, as a team, it really hurt them not to win that World Cup because they thought they were the best team in the tournament. They had played the U.S. in the gold medal game in the 1996 Olympics as well. And then I've talked to a couple of them in previous years. Like, they say that over the next 10 years or so, not only did they not have a great generation of players, but their federation really did less and less to build up women's soccer. They didn't play many games. They didn't seem to care much about youth development and investing. They didn't have many registered female players in China during those years. And I remember going to the 2004 Olympics in Greece, seeing China just get completely obliterated by Germany. I forget the score. It was like 7-0, 8-0, something like that. And realizing how far China had fallen without that generation of players and without that support. And it's nice to see them start to get it going again. This is a very young team. And I like their coach, Hao Wei, when he's not getting sent off or doing ridiculous things on the sideline. He actually seems like a pretty good coach.
And you wonder you know, the kind of added incentive maybe that that team has, I think that's kind of overlooked in this game. I mean, from the U.S. perspective, I think a lot of people look at it as just, oh, it's the USA's next step to playing Germany or France, right? I think a lot of presumptions that they're going to get there without, you know, even without Rapinoe or Holiday.
But see, like, this team, and they played each other in December in Brazil, it was 1-1.
Right, exactly. I mean, China, they're not a pushover, and obviously there's motivation there, right? So, and at the end of the day, this is the World Cup quarterfinals. Everyone's bringing their best at this point, and it's, you know, anyone watching this U.S. team can't assume that they're going to walk over anybody at this point, just with the way things are going.
Especially as Grant noted. I mean, they have one player who is capable of creating with the ball at her feet. And that's been Rapinoe. You know, she has a bit of vision, a bit of audacity. She can beat players on the dribble, and she's the only one who can make a defense, you know, make some tough decisions. And with her not being there, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, this team's going to have to pass this test in order to go into the semifinal. I mean, I still think they'll win, but you know, it's going to get real in the semifinal. You know, we've talked about how in every World Cup, you know, the U.S. should always be expected to win any game it plays, but there's always going to be two or three teams in each World Cup that can beat them. And 15 years ago, it was China and Norway and teams like that, and now it's teams like Germany, France, and Japan, and eventually they're going to have to beat one or two of those teams to win the tournament.
I'm already hearing comparisons being made to the Brazil men's team from last year's World Cup there, of getting to the semifinal and then getting obliterated by Germany, which, you know, that would be getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. But Germany or France, if the U.S. does advance, is going to be a very difficult opponent. And right now, the way the U.S. is playing, I see their scenario for victory being good defense and set pieces, and that's kind of tough on fans, I think.
Yeah, and especially, it's funny you mentioned the Brazil comparison, because I was kind of thinking about that as well, just the way this team is perceived. It's not good enough for them to win. They have to do it while looking like the best team for it to be considered a complete success, I feel like, is kind of like the general feeling right now, both in and out of the soccer community, more so in, I guess. But the fact of the matter is they've given up one goal in the entire World Cup, and it came 27 minutes into the tournament. So, look, a lot to still be done for that team, a lot to prove, which in some ways is good. And look, we'll see if they can get it done. Again, China on Friday night in Ottawa. So we will see what happens with that. Now let's switch to the U.S. men. Jurgen Klinsmann's Gold Cup roster, 23-man team that will go to, at the very least, the group stage. You can still make six changes in between the group and knockout stage, of course, should the U.S. advance, which we all expect that they would. Brian, you wrote about this for Planet Football. Any big surprises for your 23? I know DeMarcus Beasley was on the provisional list, offered to come out of retirement, and he's not on the final 23, but could come in for the knockout round. Is that something that kind of caught your eye?
Yeah, I think once we saw Beasley on that 35-man provisional roster, I guess it sort of figured, oh, he'll be in the 23. But maybe Jurgen spoke to him and just said, look, in case we have an injury, in case we're in some kind of tactical dire straits, are you willing to come in if I call you? And Beasley says, yeah, sure. And so there we are. So you know, Beasley certainly not a long-term solution for this team. And so, you know, I expect if there's an injury or something like that, that he'll be happy to come in and play the knockout rounds. The things that kind of surprised me are still in back. I expected to see Breck Shea on this team. Jurgen has put a lot of sort of time and effort into bringing Shea along and keeping him part of the group and playing him a lot of left back. He's played in, I think, six of the seven friendlies this year. But he's not on the team. And maybe that has something to do with the way things are going in Orlando, where he's been playing more mid. And then obviously Matt Beisler, here's an experienced central defender, a World Cup starter who played well in Brazil, who's good with the ball, you know, someone who you know, against CONCACAF teams, you're going to want to play the ball on the ground. You're going to want to sort of play to feet. And he's a guy who can do that. And I expected to see him on the squad as well. So those are, I think, if you're going to say there are surprises in this team, those are the two that I would point to.
Clearly, Jurgen believes that, you know, between Ventura, Alvarado, and John Brooks, he has players that not only are guys he wants to look at in the long term, but who are good enough right now to help them win games against CONCACAF opposition. And then on the outside, you know, I think all of us are kind of confused why Timmy Chandler gets chance after chance after chance. He's really never put together a comprehensive 90-minute performance in a U.S. shirt. But Jurgen likes him, and he's got the experience in the Bundesliga, so there you go. And then he's got Fabian Johnson as well listed as a defender, and he's probably still the best outside back on the roster.
Grant, I know your biggest disappointment is that Alan Gordon didn't make the final cut.
Rage, outrage.
I pretty much agree with Brian, especially Beasler. Beasley, I could see being called in for, and all of them really being called in for the knockout stage. I mean, Jurgen used that to his advantage last time around, and it worked out well. Brechtje actually scored the winner in the final against Panama. But what else stood out for you, I guess?
Yeah, I'm looking at the relationship between Clint Dempsey and Jurgen Klinsmann to an extent, because Dempsey is a guy who actually hasn't been around all that much for recent U.S. games. You know, wasn't involved in these recent wins against the Netherlands and Germany, wasn't involved in the Mexico game. You know, is the captain of the team, and obviously had that situation with a 3-game suspension last week for what happened against the Portland Timbers in the U.S. Open Cup. So I don't really know what Clint Dempsey's future as the national team captain with the national team is, and maybe he doesn't, maybe Jurgen doesn't, but clearly it's a thing where Klinsmann wants to win this tournament badly, wants to get to the Confederations Cup in 2017, doesn't want to have to go through a playoff against whoever would win this tournament. And so he's going to bring in his top guns, even if, you know, maybe from what I'm hearing, the relationship between Klinsmann and Dempsey right now is not a great one. So, you know, Jozy Altidore in as well. And here's a guy who was not involved in the games in Europe recently. So, you know, these are guys who have a track record, a proven track record with the U.S., and if Klinsmann is totally prioritizing winning the tournament, I guess it makes sense they're there.
For sure, and we get to see Bradley, Dempsey, Altidore on the field together, which has turned into somewhat of a rare occurrence, right, between injuries and bans and form and you know, just different kind of factors.
Maybe we do. I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see. You know, Klinsmann has a lot of tactical options up front and in midfield. I mean, he's been playing a lot of different formations, been using guys a lot of different ways. I mean, I feel like Giassi Zardes has been on the team for 2 weeks and has played 4 positions already, you know. So, and Giassi Zardes is the sort of player Klinsmann likes. I mean, he's got a lot of range. He's got speed. He can attack from deep, you know, deep positions on the field. He can finish. So, you know, does that mean that a guy – you know, does Clint Dempsey slow the team down at this point? I mean, Jurgen is really enamored of sort of speed and you know, kind of quick and clinical attacks. So, you know, that's why it's a bit surprising to see a guy like Brad Davis make the team. Brad Davis is not, you know, so fleet of foot anymore, even though he still hits a lovely dead ball. So there are a lot of options here for Jurgen to use, and I would expect to see him in the group stage use a lot of those options and sort of get to the point. Look, The U.S. men, in a way, are in a position similar to the women within CONCACAF. The U.S. men have made 5 straight Gold Cup finals. They hardly ever lose to CONCACAF opposition anymore. I had it in the story I wrote. They're 22-3-6 against CONCACAF teams since the start of 2012. They win almost every game they play against a CONCACAF opponent. They've lost 1 group stage game in Gold Cup history. So we're going to see Jurgen thinking about building a team that's ready to then go into the semifinals or final and beat Mexico, beat Costa Rica, win that game, rather than like stressing out over being at your peak and having your best 11 on the field in game 1 or 2. So I think we'll see some tinkering to start with. And I'm sure I'll be writing 2 stories a day about all the different tactical options he has with all of these different kinds of players and different kinds of potential formations.
I think going along with what you're saying about Davis, also Graham Zusi back in the fold.
Yes.
He's kind of been in the wilderness for a while.
He hasn't played this year. Had no appearances this year for the U.S.
Yeah, so I mean, but between the two of them, you've got some good dead ball service. And then there's Chris Wondolowski, who he's in form right now. He's I believe second leading scorer in MLS.
He is.
And he's the nicest guy, yet the most polarizing player for U.S. fans, I feel like, because there's the Belgium miss. There's the fact that people see younger players like Jordan Morris, Juan Agudelo, give them chances. Why, you know, is Chris Wondolowski really going to be in the picture for the 2018 World Cup? Things like that. But it's not about the future with this tournament. It's about right now. And right now, look, the Gold Cup stage, we've seen Wondolowski do well on it. He, what was it, 5 goals in the group stage last time around. And that's why he's on this team. And I know there's a lot of consternation over it, but I think it's pretty simple, yeah?
People still act like that play against Belgium. People act like the ball was sitting on the goal line, you know, an inch away. And, you know, Wondolowski had time to read a book, eat a sandwich, and then kick it into an empty goal. I mean, they forget the fact that the ball was coming over his shoulder. He had to take it off the bounce. And he had Courtois bearing down on him, giving him basically a sliver of the, you know, a sliver of the right side of the net to shoot at. You know, should he have put it on frame? Yeah. Do better strikers miss that chance? Absolutely. It was not a tap-in. It was a chance he'd love to have back, but to for people to act like it defines his career is insane. I mean, the guy scores goals like crazy. He's beloved by his teammates and the coaching staff. Nobody reads a penalty area better. He gets open, and he finishes as much as any American that's ever played the game in recent years. So, I mean, I have no problem with him being on this team, and I still think that a guy like Wando, if you need a goal at the end of the game, he will get you a chance. He will read the play, get on the end of something, and get you a chance. And I have absolutely no problem with him being on this roster. At the same time, he is not a long-term solution. But, you know, neither is Clint Dempsey, as Grant said. Neither is Kyle Beckerman or Nick Raimondo. I mean, a lot of these guys may not be around in 2018. But you still want him now to play in a tournament you want to win. And I'm excited to see the next generation. I'm excited to see more from Giassi Zardes. And certainly, even though he's not on the final 23-man team, every time he stepped on the field, Jordan Morris has shown us something to be excited about or to be intrigued by. So, Jurgen had to decide which way to go. He chose the here and now, but that doesn't mean that, you know, Chris Wondolowski is going to be starting in the 2018 World Cup.
Yeah, and look, he's probably not going to be starting in the 2015 Gold Cup, right? I mean, you got Altidore, Johansson,
right.
Dempsey. So, look, it's a team that's good enough to win Mexico. You know, they're bringing all their heavy hitters from Europe. Look, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. USA's Gold Cup group, Panama, Haiti, Honduras. Not a cakewalk in CONCACAF terms, but something I think we all expect the U.S. will finish atop of and move on from there. Okay, and speaking of moving on, we are going to wrap up with some MLS talk, a couple of eyebrow-raising issues for a number of different reasons. Let's start with MLS expansion in Atlanta. The Atlanta what, Brian? What are they called?
Atlanta United FC.
Hey. Ooh.
Hey.
Points for creativity.
Dropping bombs.
Well, by now, everyone, hopefully, if I get my act together, everyone will have read the story by now.
I just, my first reaction.
Underwhelmed, are you?
Sure. To be fair, though, I was also underwhelmed by Sporting Kansas City. That worked out okay. So, it's a head scratcher for me. The United FC. You put an Atletico before it, right? I mean, just go all in at this point. Atletico, Atlanta, United FC.
I thought they were going to go for Maccabi Atlanta. That was really my hope. Sporting Kansas City was a head scratcher, but. Going for them on some level was the fact that there wasn't already a team in their own league called Sporting and another expansion team coming in called Sporting and 100 teams around the world called Sporting. I spent time yesterday looking up like how many Uniteds there are. And it's astonishing. I mean, if your name can be used by every team from every city in the world, then it's not so special, is it? So yeah, it's a head scratcher, and I'm sure When they unveil the name on July 7th, they'll explain why it fits Atlanta. I look forward to hearing that explanation. They would not give it to me, no surprise.
Well, maybe, by the way, they'll consider Brian's report as a trial balloon and hear the negative feedback and then decide to change by July 7th.
I've thought about that. I think this is what – look, I mean, 20 years ago, teams were called – you had all these weird singular concept names, you know, the Pride and the Clash and the Flash and the Rush – and the Thrust and the Spirit. I mean, these nonsense names. And now we've gone 180 degrees. And what American fans seem to want is the cities and the Uniteds and the towns and the Albions. And, you know, that's where American soccer fans and marketers and owners believe the authenticity lies. So they're, look, I complain about all-white uniforms, but every time a team unveils an all-white uniform, people fall all over themselves and talk about how awesome it is. So this is what the market wants. And if Atlanta is giving their market what they want, then that's great.
I guess I would say this, too, is that if you're looking at naming a team, starting, you know, a league or a team like this, you should think about 100 years from now, am I going to feel good about this name? And if your team name is the Kansas City Whiz, and you're not thinking about 100 years from now, I guarantee you. So, you know, I will say this. In 100 years, Atlanta United FC will not be a bad name, I don't think. In my opinion. I guess I'm not as bothered by this as some folks are. It certainly seems like Minnesota United will come in as Minnesota United as well. And, you know, just – make sure you have a good logo and a mascot, you know.
Minnesota United is – that's not 100% confirmed yet, and which is, of course, probably frustrating to them. But at least they were playing under that name, you know. I mean, at least they can say, you know, we've been playing under this name for a few years. We have a brand people like. We've been doing our marketing under this name. Let us keep it. And as opposed to Atlanta, which was starting from scratch. Atlanta could have picked anything. And I think that there are certainly clubs around American soccer that have names that aren't, you know, sort of the cheesy MLS 96 / WUSA names that are
Cyber just, Rays.
Oh, when I was at the Post, I can't tell you how often one of our I probably did it too, but we had a lot of incidents where copy editors in headlines and captions, freedom, spirit, charge, power, like they would get mixed up because
this
the names
sound like
so
American cheap. Gladiators.
any of them except for Cyber Rays, of course.
I think the Chicago Fire is a great name. Let me just throw that out there, and I think it was a hard thing to come up with. That
great logo, certainly fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's a hard thing to come up with a name that is not so kind of pat and easy as Chicago United. But to come up with something that kind of it just works, and the whole branding behind it, I thought worked. Not too many MLS teams since then, in my opinion, have done a great job with that. But we've seen, you know, this is Brian's area of expertise. But I mean, like,
expertise.
I do like it is. I mean, like, I look at like the Columbus Crew redesign. I thought that was pretty well done.
There are certainly the names like the Timbers, the Sounders. Some of the older names that have roots in their community, and it, look, it makes it like Timbers, right? There are a lot of trees and logging in Portland, so that's an area specific you know, name that people from that part of the country can sort of feel tied to. I think Houston Dynamo works, you know, because of the energy industry there. Philadelphia Union, I think is a cool name and a really nice logo. You know, some of the names like Revolution and Galaxy. Actually, Kevin Payne told me that DC United was originally going to be called the Revolution. That was the Outfitters' idea. So some of these names have stood the test of time, and some of these names, you know, you can at least say, yeah, there's something about that name that ties in with this market's history or iconography or something. And like I said, I mean, Atlanta United, you know, they're going to tell us about how they hope their club can unite the diverse citizens of a city, and we'll have heard the same thing from every other team that's ever been called United. So, you know, I hope they have a good explanation for it, and I look forward to hearing it. But call me skeptical.
Look, at the end of the day, they've already sold, what, 20,000 or so, almost 20,000 season tickets, right? So, I mean, they're doing something, right?
I clearly do not represent – look, obviously those people bought it, you know, before the name, and nor should a name keep people from going to watch the sport they love. If I was a soccer fan at Atlanta, I would still buy tickets.
Sure.
But like I said, I think that, you know, I think they could have done better. I think they could have picked a name that better reflected the unique history and culture of that city. But I'm also not the market they're after, and clearly this is what people like, or otherwise so many teams wouldn't be doing it.
The FC at the end of it too. Oh, I think that just go SC if you're gonna add. I don't know. We're nitpicking a little bit.
This is where I go on my little mini rant.
And, do it, rant
a little bit. I all the time, every day of the year, still get people on Twitter from different parts of the world saying it's not soccer, it's football, and I'm so used to it by now that I usually keep my stuff together. You know, but maybe once or twice a year, I just feel compelled to send out the tweet. If we all love the sport, it doesn't really matter what name we call it. People are going to call it different names. I'm a pretty all-inclusive guy when it comes to just, you know, having a big tent and saying, if you call it football or soccer or calcio or whatever you decide to call this sport.
Nogo Metna?
What's that?
Nogo Metna.
What is that?
It's like what they call it in the Slavic and Balkan countries or something that sounds sort of like that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, I don't totally get why that seems to set people off. Not even getting into the whole history of the term soccer not being an American term, but rather an English term, which I guess I just got into. But it's just my little rant. Rant over.
All right. Well, I think we should each take a couple deep breaths. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We'll see what kind of a roster Atlanta puts together. Carlos Bocanegra, Darren Eales at the helm. And
so obvious, we'll since see. Since you're our editor. So when I'm writing about Orlando City, what's funny actually, Grant, is I would say that almost every club that has the FC after its name has at some point said to me, hey, would you mind calling us Sounders FC? Like at least once. Or Republic FC. And no, I'm not going to do that. And I'm like, okay. And then we move on. I mean, if you're Toronto FC, I have no choice. But if you're Portland Timbers FC, I'm just going to call you the Portland Timbers.
I'm just calling you Portland. I just call these teams by their cities.
Oh, on first reference, I'll say okay. Portland Timbers. Then after that, I'll say Timbers or Portland or something like that. But anyway, I was going to say that I it's also interesting how we have Orlando City, which is an SC, I believe, soccer club. Which city is kind of like the nickname, right? I mean, so we'll call them – sometimes I'll call them city on second reference. But New York City FC, New York City is the name of the place. So it's more like Toronto FC than it is Orlando City FC. So you couldn't really call New York City on second reference. These are the kinds of things I think about.
It just makes you want to pull your hair out, yeah? It's the worst.
Well, you're the editor. It's your problem.
Well, yeah. Thanks.
Ultimately, it's your problem.
All right,
you set the style, my man.
Let's get out of this downward spiral towards Hades and finish up with something awesome, and that is Andrea Pirlo. True story, the second name for this podcast was going to be No Pirlo, No Podcast.
We're good at naming too.
Maybe we should have just chosen that, because now that I've said it out loud, it actually sounds awesome. All these reports that he's going to be coming to NYCFC, that is not City FC, Brian, New York City FC, and join a midfield with Frank Lampard, with Mix Diskerud, a lot of
Ned Grabavoy,
exactly. Sebastian Velasquez, Tommy McNamara. We can name the whole roster. It's a lot of details that we still don't know yet, if he's coming this summer, if he's actually coming altogether, a lot of different reports. Operating under the assumption that he does land with NYCFC. Good move, head-scratching move. For the U.S. soccer fan, it's awesome. The more you can watch Pirlo, the better. The guy's a wizard. He's amazing. The beard, the facial expressions, he's a legend. Does it make sense for the team, Grant?
I think they're two very separate questions. I'm excited to have Andrea Pirlo coming to the United States and playing on a regular basis in the city where I live. And, you know, I think that will be a very intriguing experiment, as it were, to see how Andrea Pirlo fits in with Frank Lampard, David Villa, Mick Discrood, and that whole cast of characters. Personally, I hope that we see gossip page pictures of Pirlo and Tommy McNamara hanging out at the whatever modern day equivalent of Studio 54 is, like the old Cosmos did. Don't know if that'll happen, but as far as like the team itself,
sounds like a Stefan SNL skit waiting to happen.
Yes. As far as from a team perspective, I think it's perfectly rational to wonder if Pirlo is the perfect fit for this team. You know, I certainly thought that New York City FC wanted to go, if they're going to get a third DP, as they said they would, to go a bit younger, potentially get a forward to have alongside Villa. And Pirlo certainly is not young. He's still a very good player, obviously. But if you're putting a team together, he's not the first guy I would think of to fit into that operation. It does make me wonder what Mick Discrood is going to do.
It probably pushes Mick out to the flank, right? I mean, he's
out wide, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing it does. I mean, obviously NYCFC, you know, they've won three in a row. So they're starting to sort of pull themselves back out from the funk they were in. But I wonder if some of this is simply a function of being in New York and being a team that, you know, being a city where people want to see big names and big stars. And being in a city where perhaps the, oh, we're an expansion team, it's going to take us a couple of years to get some traction. It doesn't fly, you know, and there's going to be some expectation for this team to win right now. And so while Pirlo is probably a guy who signs for a year and a half at the most, and is certainly not a guy you're going to build a team around long term, you know, maybe he helps you win some games right now and helps you generate some noise. What I find interesting is how antithetical this is to the way Jason Christ built Real Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And Christ was hired by NYCFC because this is a guy who could build a team that could have consistent, sustainable success, an identifiable style of play that they did better than anybody else. And he showed an ability to, as the roster evolved, to bring players in who could then adapt to and continue that style of play. And RSL's sustained success from 2000, you know, starting in 08, but definitely 09 up through 2013, is one of the great runs in MLS history, especially considering the fact that they were the smallest market in the league, that they weren't paying $1 million for any player, that kind of thing. It's a remarkable achievement. And he's not being allowed to do any of that in New York. And whether he's cool with that or not, I don't know. But I do find it fascinating.
I do think the second that Jason Christ took the New York City FC job, he knew that it was going to be completely different from Salt Lake, that he was going
and a different kind of challenge. And maybe that's what he,
And the team is the star is not going to be something we see being said a lot with NYCFC. So that doesn't mean that Jason Christ can't succeed with this team. And on the face of it, having a lot more financial support is not necessarily a bad thing if you're trying to build a team. Certainly teams around the world get built with a lot of money and they bring different challenges. And I think for Jason Christ, who's a very talented coach, this is a challenge for him, but also one that he wanted. So I can't wait to see how this goes. I think it's neat to see this kind of ambition, this kind of spending, even if I don't know for certain if it's going to be successful.
I'm still baffled and upset that Pirlo didn't win the Golden Ball at the 2006 World Cup. I don't understand how anybody could have watched that tournament and voted for anybody else. It still bothers me.
Well, looks like he'll have a chance to win MLS Newcomer of the Year. So that's
right. Christ is a really ambitious guy, and he's a guy who wants to coach at the highest level. He's a guy who probably wants to coach the national team someday. And I agree with Grant to the extent that if you want to coach at higher levels, you need to coach in these kind of environments where you have big names and big stars and big expectations and big egos that you need to sort of plug in and make work and fake it till you make it. You know, and that's what a lot of big club coaches and national team coaches have to do, because I think RSL, while fantastic and while that was a wonderful run, is the exception rather than the rule at the highest levels of the game.
Yeah, well, it's something that we'll see if it plays out first, and then if it does, we'll see how it plays out.
If they announce it this weekend around the game against the Red Bulls, that would be fun.
That would be capitalizing on some buzz. And of course, if it doesn't happen, no Pirlo, no podcast. We're done packing it up. I don't actually mean that, but look, it's exciting when you have the chance to sign a player like Pirlo. I think you do it. That's what it comes down to. And you kind of, you know, make it work. You know, he's got so much skill, so much left in the tank still. Even you could see in the Champions League final, against Barcelona, and this will be my parting thought before we wrap up. I thought the coolest thing was him after the game, right? Juventus had just lost this heartbreaking final, you know, a chance for him to, you know, potentially leave this team out on top in the same stadium where he had won a World Cup. And there he is. You see all the emotion on his face. You see him taking the hugs from Xavi. You see him applauding Barcelona as they get their winners' medals. He just oozes class. And MLS would be a better place with a player like him in it. And I think that's something that we can all agree on. So,
agree.
All right. Well, on that note, we are going to wrap up the Planet Football podcast. I want to thank Grant Wall for joining us from Canada, Brian Strauss from DC. I am Avi Creditor. We will talk to you all next week.
About the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.